Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our weekly series, The World's Wackiest News, an opportunity to investigate all of the news that really is just unfit to print. It really is absolutely amazing what people do. Joining me in this quest to search out lunacy are my very good friends and co-conspirators, Manny Barling and Ashley Brooks. Good afternoon to both of you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Manny, I have a trivia-type question for you. Do you know what happened 7 years ago today?
Let me see. I woke up sober. Oh, no, I'm not sure, Simon. No, not I don't.
Believe it or not, today is the 7th anniversary of the moon rover Spirit landing on the red planet.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, and I mean, that's not bad considering, you know, the two rovers were supposedly going to be operating for 90 days and that was it. Now, I have to admit that Spirit's been a little dormant of late, but believe it or not, NASA have high hopes that one of these days it is going to phone home and get back on the mission.
Maybe they should give it some Viagra, get it started again.
Indeed.
And Simon, do you know whether they really discovered Mars candy bars on Mars, or is that just a rumor?
You know, I'm not sure. I'll have to check out Snopes.com to...
yeah, but did it have high fructose corn syrup?
Sure, someone's taking credit.
The one thing that you know, I was thinking about this morning when I realized it was the 7th anniversary, clearly NASA build far better vehicles than old British sports cars with Lucas Electronics in them.
Yes. The melting rubber parts that overheated in 40-degree weather, let alone warmer.
But right. It's the privilege of waiting for the parts to come in and be repaired.
You know, right. Simon, as a brief aside, somewhere in the 90s, Ashley always loved Jaguars. We call them Jaguars here, but it's Jaguars to those people from England. She always wanted one. I said, I'll tell you what, honey. For next year, when we drive down the street, you look at the cars that are towed in and see how many of them are Jaguars. And the first year or two was just countless, wasn't it?
It was countless. But then friends of ours purchased Jaguars, and they started calling me complaining that they needed a lift here and there because they were stuck on the freeway. So that sort of solved me from, or completely solved that, of us ever owning one.
Right. I always found the problem with British sports cars, and I was the proud owner of a couple, but there wasn't any, trunk space, because inevitably you needed to fill it up with replacement Lucas Electronics parts.
No, a number of years ago, I believe it was in the mid-80s, 86, 87, Britain decided to start making a car called the Stirling, and they took the Honda Acura that was just out. I think it was actually the top of the line of the Accord, and they shipped all the parts to England to be assembled there, except they kept the rubber parts, the brakes, the air conditioning and cooling, which are the four worst things they make in England, right?
Absolutely.
So they put their unusual British spin on this car, and they all broke down. The car stopped selling, and it was dead in, what, 2 years or something like
that? I bet you women kept buying it, though, because it was a pretty car.
Yeah, it was.
It looked nice. Key turned.
It was clearly the Edsel of England, but not quite as ugly.
Yeah, see, England has a a long history of producing very, very fine motor vehicles.
Yeah, really? You know, the Bentley is made by VW, and for years it was made in Munich at their Crystal factory. Only recently they started making it in England. And oddly enough, that's when Bentley became popular and stopped breaking it down. So it took a German motor company to fix the British cars, the same way Ford bought Jaguar. And the minute they bought it, they started shipping their air conditioning and rubber parts there. And then the last few years, Jaguars have been pretty good cars.
Mm-hmm. I do have one great story about British motor cars. I was living in a suburb of London, and a Rolls-Royce pulled to a halt right by me, and the gentleman wound his window down and asked me if I knew where a phone box was. And I said, well, I live right here. You can, you know, you're more than welcome to use our phone. His car had broken down. A Rolls-Royce broken down? You know, who's ever heard of such a thing?
Well, good. That allows me to tell my story of English cars. It was 1962, just out of high school, and people have to understand that Animal House was about my graduating class in 62, the same way American Graffiti was. So somehow we all changed over summer. And in my life, my father had released a film called A Matter of Who with the actor Terry Thomas, who I'm sure you know well, the British comedian.
Oh, yes.
So they were off to England, and I was left with this English taxi cab, the big old ones. I think they were Broadmoors with the name or something like that, and had a sign on A Matter of Who at the Crest Westwood Theater, which is right out next to UCLA's campus in Los Angeles. And my parents left me money during the summer to just drive it around and advertise the film. Well, all it was beer money for me and my friends. So we were driving around, and of course, it was right-hand drive, and people weren't familiar with it. So we'd put a guy on the left side, and we'd slow down in traffic, and I'd start weaving like the car was out of control. And he'd swing open the door and jump on the old board, the running board, and yell, "My steering's gone, my steering's gone," and everyone would slam their foot in the brakes to avoid us like we were some runaway train. And we would laugh and have a great time. So that's how we morphed from American Graffiti into Animal House.
Right. The real cute part about the Rolls-Royce story is, you know, when he explained that he'd just broken down, I said, oh, well, certainly you can use my phone, and I can even give you the number of a local garage. And he said, oh, that won't be necessary. I'm just going to call Rolls-Royce. They will send technicians out.
How long did it take?
Oh, only a couple of hours.
Oh, okay. Well, it's not too bad.
You know, oddly enough, Mercedes-Benz and Porsche, and I think Cadillac also offers the same service. They have their own road service, and there's someone assigned at the local dealers, and when you call in, they send a actual Mercedes mechanic, whoever is on duty at the closest dealer. Isn't that amazing?
Oh, yeah. I love it.
I can't imagine Ford doing that. Can you imagine Ford or Honda or Toyota doing that?
Not really. You want us to do what?
Assume you can get through to them.
Okay, now, back to the plot here. English motor cars are a source of great humor, but...
Oh, terrifically so.
Well, I have an then we will start with an important tie-in story, because nothing ties in more with British cars than our lead story, that a thief nabbed 153 bras from Victoria's Secret. I know those tie together, but Ashley, tell us about that story.
Well, it's a serious issue because somebody came in and nabbed 153 bras from the women's undergarment store on December 20th for a total value of $9,675, of an average of $63 a bra. I don't have no clue how somebody could walk into a store. I have this image because I understand that people used to steal clothes by going into the ladies' room and putting on one piece at a time and then walking out. So did this person go in and put on 153 bras going from no chest to well-built before leaving?
I can see him now patting them. Oh, I had injections last week.
Seriously? And what do you do with it? On the 12th day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 153 bras.
You know, my favorite about the story, Simon, I'm sure you have a reaction to this too, is when the great quote from the Northbrook Police Department, "The police have no suspects and aren't sure how the thief managed to steal that many bras." Oh, what an inane comment.
I mean, don't they have cameras?
What do you think about that?
Well, I can only assume that he was obviously disguised, walked in looking something like Twiggy, and, you know, walked out claiming to be Dolly Parton's twin sister.
Okay, so what do you think he's doing with 153 bras? You think they're on eBay?
You know, that is a distinct possibility. Either that or he is the ultimate gigolo.
Can you see the guy next to a high school campus, not selling drugs, but, "Hey, little girl, you want a bra?"
Sick Manny.
Sorry.
You know, there's one time I was in a store over in Westwood. It was the Ross store. And I was waiting in line, and all of a sudden, a couple of big, huge thug guys had picked up racks of clothes. I mean, their arms were packed full of clothes, several of them, and ran right past me, almost knocked me down, almost gave the woman next to me a heart attack, literally, and got in their getaway car, packed full of people, and took off.
Yeah, they were probably ex-University of Florida football players who had the most arrests of any college football team around. So, you know, check the local football players, see if they're giving them out on campus.
It's pretty frightening, but 153 bras.
Yeah, so, we're going to move on with that one to two other great stories. And, of course, this one is really interesting. Another lead story is a Brazilian McDonald's manager wins an obesity lawsuit. Can you imagine that? He claimed that he got fat, packed on 65 pounds, eating free lunches and food sampling.
But he was forced for the sample because critics were coming in, and he wanted to make sure the food was right. So subsequently, he had to keep eating the food.
So people
burger
don't know
for
this.
You, burger for me, burger for you.
That's right, one for you, one for me. There you go, Simon.
It turns out McDonald's sends mystery clients who are tasked with visiting franchise and evaluating the food quality and cleanliness. So he felt obligated to sample the food every day. Yeah, right. That's what the 600-pound person said who worked in the market. You know, somebody had to do it.
Well, and he got $17,500 for this?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's in Brazilian dollars. So here, that's probably $500,000.
Oh, wow.
I love it. He scolded McDonald's for offering free lunches to his employees, charging that the meals, which consisted mostly of hamburgers, french fries, and ice cream, increased his daily caloric intake. You think it did? Wow. Are you shocked? You know, if anyone has listened to our Surviving the 21st Century show knows that's about 5,000 milligrams of salt and about 500 grams of sugar. I mean, it's just a huge amount. And if you eat that, if you worked a long shift, probably had an Egg McMuffin for breakfast, hamburger and fries for lunch, and then he had to taste the Big Mac at dinner to make sure everybody was fine, and he probably looked like somebody put a bicycle pump on his navel and pumped him up.
I wonder if he could remove the ammonia. That's part of the ingredients, so I wonder. What gets me, though, is that in June, the Center for Science and Public Interest served McDonald's with a notice to file a lawsuit that they can't serve the Happy Meals because it's unhealthy junk food. Why is it only the Happy Meal? I mean, I'm sorry, Simon, what?
I thought the deal was that they could continue to serve Happy Meals. They just couldn't give away the toys. I mean, and I guess the toys are really fattening.
Where the toys are the healthy part? No, you're right. The unhealthy part of the lunch.
Well, I thought the Center for Science Public Interest said it really well, and they said it basically it makes it impossible for parents by giving away toys, and they compared it to, quote, a stranger on the playground handing out candy to children. You know,
it's all that MSG.
You know,
right.
No, it's basically
actually,
it's addicting.
Yeah, actually, McDonald's has a long and, I'll use the word illustrious, history of interesting lawsuits. Do you remember the one about the woman and her coffee?
Oh, yes. One of my law school classmates won that case. He got a couple million dollars for the coffee was too hot and it spilled on him. He was a very good law student and a good lawyer, so it didn't surprise me. And in Los Angeles, he runs these. His name's Ed Steinbrecher, and he runs these ads in Los Angeles. And boy, we all look at him like, where did he go wrong? But he's made a fortune off of McDonald's.
Indeed.
My favorite McDonald's is a number of years ago. A variety of vegetarians learned what the rest of us who grew up in Los Angeles knew, and that is that they were using beef lard to cook their fries, which tastes a lot better but is not very healthy. So all these vegetarians and Muslims, and I believe the lawsuit was filed in Oregon, sued McDonald's that they were destroying their vegetarian diet, blah, 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 and all sorts of fraud. So what do? They decide, okay, we'll pay the American Heart Association $7 million to settle this lawsuit. It goes to charity. We won't do it anymore. First of all, giving the American Heart Association $7 million is like giving it to the biggest bureaucratic department. It's sort of like the Red Cross. You wonder how much money really is used to help people. But off of that for a moment, within 2 years, they were putting the lard back in. So they got caught again 3-4 years later using lard in their making their fries. So they just basically said, the heck with you, and move right on. The $7 million fine to McDonald's is like a $5 parking ticket.
Right.
You know what gets me, though, Manny? This is kind of like I've heard Sarah Palin have this argument. This is sort of like what the attorneys did to oppose this particular first lawsuit, the Brazilian one, that the parents feel strongly they believe they have a right and responsibility to decide what's best for their children. Mm-hmm. It's really that simple. Can you believe that?
Well, that's probably
actually,
true.
Actually, what really scares me is, this threat that Sarah Palin may run for president.
she's got a lot of fans out there.
Well, you know, I don't want to be politically incorrect. I'll do it anyway. But if she runs, it'll help the Democratic Party. And what happened in California is the Tea Party divides the Republican Party, and they end up electing a Democrat, which is how one of the ways Jerry Brown beat the Republican nominee this year. And they're in danger of doing serious harm to the Republican Party. But, you know, this happened with William Jennings Bryan and the Silver Movement from 1890 to 1926, and it can happen in our country, too. But anyway, I want to get back to McDonald's. You know, Ashley talks about this parent thing. I was on the radio a couple days ago on a show in Ocala, Florida, and one of the reporters, I should say the interviewer, said to me, well, don't you think we're interfering with the parents? And I said, well, you know, there's a lawsuit pending in New York, and the suit alleges that obesity, diabetes, coronary heart disease, high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol intake, and other detrimental and adverse effects in McDonald's are causing diseases and health problems in New York. And New York wants to stop them because they feel the state is spending all this money in medical costs. San Francisco and Northern California banned the Happy Meals toys because they think it's contributing to childhood obesity and all these other health problems, and that sooner or later we as local citizens are going to pay for it in the form of taxes to cover Medi-Cal, Medicare, you know, all the different benefits. So there is some concern that we pay for these things.
Well, you know, I think New York has a very valid point of view, and in fact it could be argued that, you know, because of the burden that fast food is putting on their system, might be one of the reasons they have been a little slow in cleaning up the snow.
Certainly a deterrent. Well, I want you to know what McDonald's position is. This quote, McDonald's offers a large variety of options and balanced menus to cater to the daily dietary needs of its employees. And whoever wrote the article that we pulled on this said, perhaps the plaintiffs should have spent more time tasting the salads. But I don't think from what we've published, the salads
are any better.
They have the same salt and calories and cholesterol as the burgers.
Plus, it's all genetically modified, so there you go.
And I don't want to single out McDonald's. You can pick Burger King. I mean, we point out that Burger King's strawberry milkshake has 54 ingredients in it. You can make it at home with strawberry ice cream and milk. So what are the other 52 ingredients? It's like Doritos, which has 39 ingredients. It takes only 3 to make corn chips at home. So what are the other 36 ingredients? And that's what McDonald's and the rest of them are battling, is the fact that they're just stuffing chemicals, most of them addicting, and they're becoming the drug dealers of America. They basically are peddling foods with chemicals in it to make sure people drool, get fat, hungry, and come back and buy some more.
I think this is going to change, though. For example, along with all the complaints and things that are going on, and now that they have to put their ingredients on their menu, people are actually becoming more and more aware. Plus, there's groups like PETA, which is the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, who own now, in the last 7 years, they've scooped up 80 companies of McDonald's and Kraft that they own. So we're hoping that maybe their influence with the type of animals and manner in which the food is prepared, that there'll be a healthier McDonald's. It could go back to the McDonald's of your youth, Manny.
I think they're just going to go underground. And that there's going to be these sleazy... No, McDonald's.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's going to be these sleazy guys on street corners, you know, near schools.
Or there's going to be people who are going to start hoarding hamburgers and McDonald's hamburgers and french fries, because if anybody has seen how well they hold up after a four-year period, and I think there's one out there for 7 years, too, on a video.
You know, Simon, that means the TV show Criminal Minds, for those who watch it, I'll give up doing shows on pedophiles and do it on McDonald's guys staying on a street corner and they're just going, want a burger, baby?
It's only 10, and it's only 10 years old.
Yeah. I'll give you a Happy Meal toy. Shh, don't tell anybody. Well, I think we're getting too serious with food. We could go all day on fast food. So let's move on to
speaking of McDonald's, Ann.
Before we move on, we have a caller on the line. Do you fancy taking a call?
Well, unless it's from McDonald's, go ahead. Let's go.
Okay, caller from the 928 area code, and I do hope it's not a McDonald's rep. You're on the air. What's your name and what's your question or comment for us?
Hey, I just want to let you guys know the radio show fucking sucks dick.
Unfortunately, he seemed to have been cut off.
I guess he's a McDonald's fan.
I think I've had too much fast foods.
Right. Yeah. OD'd on Big Macs.
Well, let's talk about a story he'll like, okay? It's a champion liar of 210 awards goes to a guy in Wisconsin. I want you to know that lawyers were not eligible for this contest, or the first 10 people would have been lawyers. So, since it wasn't. So this is a liar's club that really does it for humor and has a good time. And this gentleman, David Miltz, in Wisconsin, basically was named the top 10 liar of top liar, 2010, and this was his line. I almost had a psychic girlfriend, but she left me before we met. Okay.
But winning a liar's contest from a person who's a school superintendent, okay, where do you hang the plaque?
And more than that, it turned out that it was stolen from a comedian named Stephen Wright. Of course, he claimed he never heard of the comedian, and it's a small group, so they didn't bother to check it. So then he definitely is the biggest liar in Wisconsin if he did. Of course, in all fairness to him, he said he'd never heard that before and created it himself. So it's
all and I found this clip kind of interesting. Didn't you, Simon? The fact that it's been around since 1929. It's called the Burlington Liars Club. And they have they received 500 entries this year, and I guess you can join for $1 a year.
What a deal.
It's a deal for the person collecting it, I guess.
Right.
Well, and where else can you go and pay $1 to tell a lie? Most of the time it's free.
Right. Yeah, I love the concept. And, you know, a dollar a lie, no doubt the biggest lie is you'll get a free monthly newsletter.
I just can't imagine being a school superintendent and some mom bringing their kid in with this huge plaque behind the guy the whole time they're talking to him. Please help my child. Looking at this, I have won the best liar of the year.
Right.
Well, you know, maybe we ought to move on and to something else. The East Coast, as we know, is having terrible weather for last month. We all know that the football game in Philadelphia was put off until a Tuesday night. But what I find so interesting is those who have not heard the comments of Ed Randell, the governor, you've got to listen to this. He was so upset the game was moved, he said, "We've become a nation of wusses. The Chinese are kicking our butt in everything. If this was in China, do you think the Chinese would have called off the game? People have been marching down the stadium. They would have walked and they've been doing calculus on the way down." Now, this is one macho governor. Then he finished with, what do you think Hall of Fame coach Vince Lombardi would say? He would say we've become a nation of wusses. I think Vince Lombardi, who was a Latin English professor, would have picked a little better word than wusses. But so for all you people who are suffering miserably in the weather in the East Coast, you're being labeled wusses. So Ashley had a wonderful story. Well, I want to get her to join in. About the snow plow in Brooklyn, honey. Tell us about it.
Well, anybody who hasn't seen the video really should go to the internet and turn on. The snow plow rips a car and causes damage. This was an incredible thing to watch because having grown up in the snow in Ohio and then in Chicago, oh, my gosh, I have never seen somebody on road rage with a snow plow. He kept ramming this car. He ran one car into another car. He took the side of the snowplow and ripped this person's SUV apart. And people are screaming for this person to stop, and he just kept plowing along. And he ran one car into the other car. And subsequently, he destroyed this person's. It was all belonged to the same person.
Oh, he got the whole one family.
One family in one fell swoop.
And I love Mayor Bloomberg. He says, "Oh, I'll leave it to the lawyers, but I assume we probably are responsible if our plow hits them." Isn't that an understatement?
Yeah, but he proceeded also to say that, according to New York Times Daily, was that he kept saying that the buck stops here and that he was willing to take responsibility. But then council people came after him saying that he was Baghdad Bob for not taking care of it and leaving them in a third world country. And how is he ever going to run for president if he can't handle the snow? So I guess the next time if he tries to run for president, even though he's done a beautiful job in New York, he will be known as Baghdad Bob.
Yes, I enjoyed the Baghdad Bob quote.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And while we're on trucks and cars, Ashley found another one that got me. It was a dramatic CCTV, which is, you know, the closed-circuit TV, much like they use in London. The footage captured a man narrowly avoiding certain death. He managed to outrun a truck that was about to hit him. This is on YouTube. You can watch this guy. He could have made an All-American football team the way he was running. So.
Well, if this happened in Spain, he would be the winner of who's outrunning the Bulls.
But it happened in a small city in Turkey. And he was just casually crossing the street at a red light. The light turned green. The guy in the truck claimed he didn't see him. Actually, I think he probably thought he was 30 points and took off after him. And they finally, pedestrians got to get got a chance to get the truck driver's attention. But when you take a look at the film, he threw himself on the road and got out of the way. He was lucky to be alive.
I actually couldn't believe the footage. Did you see it, Simon?
No, actually I haven't, but you can rest assured that it's now on my to-view list.
You know,
it was frightening, actually. I mean, the thought of being in a crosswalk with a massive truck, which Spielberg's movie, Manny, the one with the truck?
Yeah.
I had that flashback moment of that.
It slips my mind. Isn't it terrible? It's his first movie shot in Los Angeles with the truck that pursues Dennis Weaver all over the North San Fernando Valley. I'll remember in a moment. But, you know, if you know the guy isn't hurt, then it's funny to watch. Because, you know, one man's danger is another man's humor, you know. And at the same time, I actually found another one. There was a Turkish guy that miraculously ducked under a train when the train was colliding with a truck and survived. And he was on the CCTV, so it wasn't somebody telling the story. They captured the moment where he disappeared under the wheels to hide during the collision, and he survived. But when they went to interview him, the guy had no recollection of the incident. Can you imagine surviving a train and truck collision without, you know, even remembering? I don't know if this guy is smoking it, but he should spread it around a little bit.
That's right. He was obviously on some really good Turkish stuff.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
And it wasn't turkey at Thanksgiving either.
Right.
I mean, you know, I don't want to quote Barbara Bush about President Clinton, but there are a lot of things that you forget in your life, but not one of them is dodging a truck-train collision.
No, I got a feeling it's kind of something that is likely to stick in your mind for a little while.
At least a week. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I drive in Los Angeles, and you just don't jaywalk on major streets in Los Angeles. It's about a $250, probably it's higher than now, ticket if you get caught jaywalking Ventura Boulevard or Wilshire Boulevard or Sepulveda, the major streets. And I know, Simon, you've driven Los Angeles a fair amount. You can imagine what it's like to jaywalk on those streets? Oh, my God, you're taking your life in your hand.
You take your life in your hand crossing at the crosswalk.
Yeah, true.
Jaywalking.
Only exceeded by Rome. If any of our listeners have ever driven in Rome, or Paris for that matter, that's the ultimate in crazies. Ash and I were sitting in a van going into downtown Rome, and I looked out the side, and I was sitting on the passenger side, in the rearview mirror, the side mirror, I should say, I saw a car driving down the sidewalk. I said, Ashley, take a look at this. And here was this little, smallest Italian car I could think of with two women in it, girls probably in their 20s, rushing to work, driving down the sidewalk. The light turned green. They jumped the sidewalk, cut in front of everybody, and took off.
It would have been great in a movie. It really would have been. It was like a great escape. And that, and then on the freeway, they would, or whatever they call it over
yeah.
there, they would chase.
Let me tell the
story. Okay.
We're in bumper-to-bumper traffic on the freeway, and they have an emergency shoulder for ambulances and police. So I could hear the sirens, and I looked again in the side-view mirror, and I saw an ambulance go by. And, you know, you understand, we're stopped going 5 miles an hour, and this guy is going like 70 miles an hour, and he whisked past our car like a rocket, which is scary if you've ever seen people do that in a motorcycle in traffic. But following him were four cars, so people decided to beat the traffic, and they were racing 70 miles an hour behind this ambulance on the shoulder to avoid traffic. You know, and people think it's tough to drive in the United States. It's easy.
Actually, you mentioned Paris. I spent a lifetime there one long weekend. Dreadful city.
I'm not crazy about it either.
Right. And anyway, what I noticed was that the cars were all parked on one side of the road. Everything's pointing in the same direction, and all of the cars have dings on the roadside of the vehicle, and they're all, you know, perfectly fine on the pavement side.
Do you think they have snowplows there too?
Well, no, I did find out, you know, firsthand one of the issues. Parking is at a premium, and you know, this was in the sometime in the early 70s, and a good Parisian driver never put the parking brake on, right? Because what the next person parking would do was go, oh, that hole isn't quite big enough for the car.
No way,
well,
Simon.
Yeah,
well,
no problem.
I can just nudge everything out the way, you know.
There are no lanes painted. There are no crosswalks painted. Everybody loves that beautiful scene of the Champs-Élysées where they go around the big circle. Well, they should have a big sign up. You're now entering every man for himself territory, because the way people drive around there is absolutely insane.
Oh, and yes. In fact, this has nothing to do with cars. The only reason I was persuaded to spend this, you know, hell on earth time was I really, really wanted to see the Louvre. Yeah, right. I'm a fan of Salvador Dali, believe it or not, and the Louvre has this wonderful collection of original Dalis. Ah, so it's the last day in Paris, you know, and I'm going, thank God. We've got to go to the Louvre. Guess what? The Louvre is only closed one day a year. I go on Bastille Day. That one day.
July 14th, right? Yeah, I have news for you. Finding it is very difficult. Just finding the Mona Lisa requires a tour guide and three maps. I mean, it's very hard to find art. The Louvre's just got so much stuff there. You know, I always thought you were a little twisted, Simon, but if you like Salvador Dali, as an artist, you are a lot twisted.
So do you guys remember reading about the article over Christmas where some lady was in a car with a baby, and she stole somebody else's parking spot. And the woman came along and was so outraged that she actually knifed the woman with a baby.
Yes,
so I guess parking is actually worse here than it is in France.
No.
I think I'd rather have bumpers that are banged. It's pretty frightening.
Well, you remember those little Yugos that were such a joke in that period of time, the little Yugoslavian cars? Well,
oh, indeed.
They sold them in the Eastern Bloc. I had a rare opportunity to be behind the curtain on a tour, and we started in Budapest. And there they try these little Yugos, and they park them on the sidewalks like bicycles. So to walk down the sidewalk, you had to navigate between all these parked Yugos, because the streets are so narrow, they can't really park on the streets there.
What's a Yugo?
It was a Yugoslavian car that was somewhere between a, you know, those little electric handicap things that people drive. And imagine cutting a Volkswagen in half and calling it a car.
Oh, Yugo.
Yes. Actually, I don't know if you've ever come across the Russian vehicle, the Moskvich.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I worked with a guy who, for reasons that defy sanity, decided he wanted to buy one. He took me out for a drive in it, and I think it pretty much had the handling characteristics of a tank.
Oh, yeah. Well, Russian cars as a whole left a lot to be desired. Basically, you know, the Russian government during the revolution converted all the American car makers, Ford and Chrysler were the primary ones, and they basically turned them into state manufacturers, and they really did not progress technology-wise very much after that. Their cars are just out of the dark ages. Then by the 50s, they look like they were all driving Edsels.
One of the things that I've been watching in the news fairly carefully is how the economic downturn has affected the population as a whole. And I believe there's a story out there about someone stealing copper.
Yeah, well, that's exactly where we were going. And you're in the New Orleans area. There was a story that in the Ninth Ward, a property owner shot a 41-year-old man who tried to steal copper from his flood-damaged house and attacked him with a large piece of wood. And actually what happened, he was in a FEMA trailer and heard this noise outside, ran out with his gun and cell phone. I don't know why you'd put a gun and cell phone together. And the guy, when he called him on it and said to stop, the guy turned on him with a board and he shot him. Can you believe that? Well, first of all, I thought the first rule of crime is boards don't trump guns. Right?
But, I mean, how pathetic that you're going to go to a FEMA truck or a FEMA van, a FEMA home, and steal its copper wire. I actually didn't realize until we were talking about this article, Simon, how much copper has been stolen all over the place, including in L.A. I guess there were like 700 lights down in the downtown L.A. area because people were stealing the copper wire out of the Los Angeles City wire, I mean the lamps.
Right, and it's actually a potentially dangerous activity because if there's juice flowing down it, ow!
Yeah. Well, these guys look like, or what I've seen, are real pros. And by the way, the guy in New Orleans said that that it wasn't unusual that it was going on all the time in his neighborhood. And, you know, one part of Los Angeles on the east side, a group of guys broke into a transformer and stole the 50 pounds of copper it takes to operate it and shut down the whole neighborhood about 2 years ago or 3 years ago, which is really amazing to me.
And unfortunately, the crime people are saying they think it's because the drugs have become more expensive, so people are stealing copper wire. But they thought that the copper wire thieves' theft would be decreased by the fact that the copper is now only $2.50 an ounce, I think it is. It was $4 an ounce. So they thought this would cause a depletion in the theft of copper right now, but it's still pretty wide.
Yeah. I mean, it's $64 a pound for copper. I mean, geez, that's rivaling, gold in many respects. Now, gold right now is probably $1,600 a pound.
Well, what concerns me is, you know, you mentioned drugs. I mean, what do people do with this copper? Do they smoke it?
No. They find they melt it down into raw goods and then sell the raw copper to people in the copper business. There's a black market for copper, magnesium, and a wide variety of other materials. Phosphorus is another one. And the problem is some of them, like phosphorus, are used to make bombs. And let's add to that story. One of the other stories they actually found was about a farm cop who sees the growth of the agricultural kind in what we call California's Central Valley. And for those listeners around the country, California is sort of broken up into three areas: Southern California, where Los Angeles and San Diego is; Northern California, which is Sacramento and San Francisco going north; but the center of the state is called the San Joaquin Valley, and it is a valley surrounded by mountains, and that's where probably 70% of the vegetables and fruits grown in the California and a significant number across the country are grown. Walnuts, everything, asparagus, broccoli. I mean, when you drive down California's Highway 5, you probably drive 200 miles through nothing but farmland through there. So all of a sudden, they're having a problem with the theft. And Tulare, which is by where Sequoia National Forest is, actually have agricultural police. You want to tell us about that, Ash?
Sure. They have John Whaley, who's a sheriff detective and also a farmer, and he goes after people who are stealing. And I don't know what else you want me to say about that, man.
Well, you know, basically, here's a guy who's a farmer. His family raises walnuts, plums, and they actually have cattle on 50 acres, but he doubles as a cop. So in his 4 years in law enforcement, he'd seen a wide array of crimes, as he discussed in these articles. in the last 2 months in Tulare, they recovered 10 tons of walnuts, bags of avocados, 3 cows, a golf cart. Now, I mean, what is a golf cart doing on the farm? A forklift, 2 tractors, batteries from tractors, fuel tanks, and a Kawasaki mule.
Oh, well, this one is the one that gets me. When he says that he bets on a moonlight night someone's going to be out there in the walnuts. I mean, can you imagine getting your day dressed up to go steal walnuts for the evening?
I love how 10 tons. What do you do? Stick them in your pocket? I mean, what do you? I mean, that means you got to show for the whole, you know, array of trucks and line them up to steal 10 tons and hire farm workers, or else they, you know, broke into, you know, a place where the 10 tons were already picked. But that's a huge amount of walnuts.
So I guess these farm cops are going out into the fields with cameras, tracking devices, and night goggles.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if they're doing what some places do, try and stop deer poachers, you know, putting up decoys, you know, maybe decoy walnut trees.
Oh, that's
a smart idea. That's brilliant.
We have a friend, the grandson of famous director Frank Capra did It's a Wonderful Life. Jimmy's a U.S. Marshal. Now he's working in Alaska, but for a while he was in Missouri. And that's what they did. They took these painted deer, stuck them out in the woods, hid across the road, and waited for guys to show up in trucks and start shooting the deer, and they would arrest them for poaching or shooting out of season. And although you said it was extremely dangerous, because those guys, after a few brewskis, would turn and be tempted to fire against U.S. Marshals, which is very dangerous. So
for everyone involved.
Everyone. But no, I mean, these farm police, literally, Ashley's right. They have GPS tracking devices, night vision goggles. Pretty soon they'll be hiring ex-Navy SEALs. In fact, honey, we can do maybe a movie script on it, right? Navy SEAL goes home to Central Valley and becomes, the Black Knight of agricultural thieves.
Oh, I had no idea how much stuff they were stealing. I didn't know they were out there siphoning off gas and copper and stealing wires and all sorts of farm equipment. I had no idea it was this bad. And you're right, Simon. It's got to be part of the economy right now.
Mm-hmm.
The worst, one of the funniest to me, though, and it probably shouldn't be funny, but it is the gal and her team who were spotted for stealing avocados. And so they ran off, and the girl left her car with her cell phone. So, of course, they got the girl, and then the girl's cell phone gave up the guy, so they're all in jail now over stealing avocados.
Another good use for a cell phone, right?
I mean, how do you run off and forget your car?
Going back to the business about the person with the plank versus the person with the gun and cell phone,
I can
only assume that he was running, you know, his cell phone was an iPhone, and he just installed the hot new app, the EyeSight.
Either that or he got one from M in the Bond films, and it fired 3 shots. You never know.
Right. All you do is duct tape your iPhone to the top of your shotgun.
aiming device, right?
Well,
I guess this is
today's modern way of stealing. Instead of cattle wrestling, they're now stealing wire wrestling.
Right.
But, you know, Simon, coming back to the Central Valley, one of the strangest calls he talked about is that thieves took 54 brass valves for an irrigation system on an orange farm. So the guy came out to turn on his irrigation to water his trees, and all the valves were gone. And so at the same time, they also started to check around, and the guy at the same time they siphoned hundreds of gallons of fuel from a diesel tank on his field. So they, you know, besides stealing the brass, they went for all the fuel.
Do you know that caused 27 deaths down in Mexico? They had a pipeline area that they were stealing, they were siphoning off, and it had been siphoned off 60 times over the course of a year, and the number 60 exploded, and it killed 27 people. So it's really a serious issue, not only dangerous for the person doing it, but it's also dangerous. I mean, it's a serious crime. 60 people.
Right. But I mean, is it the economy?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, to me, the idea of sneaking out in the middle of the night to go steal
moonlight.
Someone's
gotta be
walnuts.
Well,
right.
Yeah,
Simon, in that particular area of California, the unemployment's up to 17%, which means when you adjust, it's more like 21%. And there's I think Visalia was in the top five cities with foreclosures listed. It's just there's a ton of people out of work, as they observe up there, and that is a problem. But you look at Ohio, which is another state that's suffering terrible financial problems. In Ohio, thieves took tractor batteries. In Texas and Oklahoma, they said they're stealing cattle, you know, which will get you lynched in that area. And they're taking farm equipment from all over. And, yes, this is directly related to the economy. And why are they stealing it? Because farmers aren't like most businessmen. I mean, basically, their property is in the wide open. They don't have a way to secure it within four walls. And on a large farm, what do? Hire security guards? I mean, most of them are, you know, older than I am, and they're just going to fall asleep out there in the middle of the night anyway.
And steal your walnuts.
Ooh, that hurts.
Yeah, you're right. It's the 17% is unemployed in Tulare right now.
Yeah, which
is why they had 105 agricultural crimes in 3 months. In September,
yeah,
that's millions of dollars.
I don't want to seem hung up on walnuts, but you,
you
know,
are though. Go ahead.
Walnuts are not my walnuts.
Right, but I mean, 10 tons of walnuts. I mean, are there walnut fences? You know?
Well, they're talking about putting serial numbers on everything, but that takes a little time to put them on walnuts. You know,
well,
and tracking device.
Yeah, people that, I know someone that can fence 10 tons of walnuts.
Well, you know, Central California, pretty hardcore, so they might even get a satellite over it. You never know.
Wow, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. That's a good way to catch them.
But, you know, this is too much. We've got to move into a really serious story right now. This is for pet owners and people who have bored animals, bored dogs, cats. I mean, we have two cats, and we try to keep them busy because if not, they keep us busy. So we came across a story about a tail that wags dogs' owners, okay? People with border collies, they get bored dogs. They don't know what to do with them. They rent flocks for their bored collies. So we now have a compulsive sheep herder's need to entertain them. Can you imagine that? That if you have an unhappy dog, you take them out on Saturday morning to herd sheep? So where do you go? Do you go to Avis? You go to Hertz? You go to Enterprise? How about rent a sheep, you know? That's the latest thing.
They're actually renting flocks of sheep?
I rather enjoyed the story. I thought it was great.
Well, you know, and there's a story about this lady named Sue Foster, and she basically had a bored collie, and it started doing this. So she bought another border collie and rented some grazing land. Then she bought some sheep of her own, and a third border collie. Now that the lady had... it's a story like the old lady who swallowed the fly. She just kept getting more sheep. Then she bought a llama to chase off the coyotes that threatened the lambs. And this is in a penny in a pound. Once she started,
all the entertainer dog.
Right, all the entertainer dog. I mean, I love my dog, but you know. So anyway, now she got carried away and she created this whole little farm. And as she said, she never dreamed it would go that far. So basically, she started getting herding experts. And believe me, there are herding experts. So she brought people over from Scotland and other areas to teach the dogs how to herd and help people. So it started snowballing. Word got out. And each day there's an average of 18 dogs visit her place called Fido's Farm outside Olympia, Washington. And they pay $15 per dog to practice on the 200 herd of flea of sheep. I mean, you never know when you live in Los Angeles when you're going to find 200 sheep in your front yard and need your border collie to move them. I mean, it's a problem in Los Angeles, right?
Oh, it's a huge problem.
Not all the sheep have four legs. There are plenty of sheep in Los Angeles.
But that means that's one less person that is no longer on unemployment, the dog.
So tell me, Simon, you think this will replace dog parks?
Oh, absolutely. I think this is the next big thing. In fact, I personally wish I had thought of it.
Oh, please. I mean, hey, listen to this. Before they put a dog out there, the new dogs get a 30-minute herding evaluation to weed out the biters. One crucial test is, does the dog instinctively know it should circle around the sheep, not charge into the center of the flock? Okay. I mean, I guess if your dog charges in the center of the flock, it's blackballed and it can't go to school there.
Oh, I love this Bog Hickman story, though. The 69-year-old, Manny?
Yeah, go ahead.
69-year-old retired Army officer is a regular at Fido's farm. He drove to Valva's station wagon, was living in Tacoma when he got his first border collie. I try to come early to beat the crowd. With that many dogs, his sheep rental bills were getting so high, he cut a deal with her to swap fence building and deworming and other work for time with the flock. I mean, where's Woody Allen when you need him?
What's even funnier is that, you know, because I always think of that scene in his movie, Love and Death, with the sheep running around, and it says that sheep that spend too much time being herded become dog broke. So I guess if they use the same sheep too much, they see the dogs coming and the sheep go, okay, guys, let's get in a circle, let's get it over with, and let's go to lunch.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. No one's bothered to ask the sheep whether they want to do this, right?
Right. Who's buying lunch today?
Yeah.
I guess it's the retired Army officer.
Well, you know, as one sheep said to the other one, yeah, beef's going to market, doesn't it? Yeah, it really is interesting. In a time when our country is morphing into a more of a technological society and people are being laid off in corporations because machines are replacing them, they're finding new areas like this to change and grow new jobs and new businesses that are, I mean, who thinks of these? I mean, a fertile mind, or maybe they live in California where certain drugs are legal if you have health problems. I don't know.
Oh, my gosh, this woman really did create an entire business. They pay, PetSmart pays her $500 a year to rent 7 acres of grazing land.
Yeah, and you know what cracks me up? There's a comment in this story. It's about at the sheepdog trials, handlers compete for cash and glory, but the dogs have simpler needs. This was, quote, you don't have to treat the dogs with food. Their reward is the sheep. Can you imagine that? So these poor sheep aren't even being paid. They're sort of like, you know, NC2A football players that don't get any money.
Is there the possibility that the sheep might form a union?
Well, there are up to 48 of them, and they pay as much as $500 a year to rent the 7 acres to keep them. So I'd be very careful. Some of these unions might join them. Maybe the teachers' union. That'd be good for them. No, anyway, they do have a certain amount of physical injuries, and oddly enough, the physical injuries come from unseen holes or collisions with sheep. I guess the unseen holes are things that cause dogs, and not so much dogs, but sheep to break their legs. So I just want to know what they're doing with the sheep to break their legs, okay? I wonder if they're showing up at the barbecue at the end of the day.
Oh, geez, man, that's a horrible way to end this.
I really like lamb.
Well, I wasn't thinking it was horrible. I was wondering if we'd get invited for running a story about them.
Oh, I don't know about that, Manny. Well, last week, Simon, somebody said on the UFO show, oh, piss on it. So, and then apologized. So I said, you know, that is really a vulgar word, and I want to know more about it, because my mom always said that's something you should never say, and I'll let people always think of you as a lady. So I'm going to talk about it for a brief moment, how the word piss came from the lower-class characters of the Wife of Bath and Geoffrey Chaucer's 14th-century work, The Canterbury Tales. is associated with vulgarity and the classification to piss off, to piss poor, and therefore it became a vulgar word because the lower people used it. And I think it actually started, though, when the Romans were charging a tax on tea.
Yeah, can you imagine that? Although the way we're going with our sewer system in the United States, we could all be taxed for that. Oh, my goodness, with all the fast foods and high fructose corn syrup. Last thing people want to do is get taxed for the waste they put in the system, right?
I think urine has a really bad rap. I mean, it's a terribly useful subject, product.
I was actually surprised by how useful it is. Because you just think of it as, waste, protein, gone, something you have to do,
Well, wait a minute, and this is entirely true. Do you know that people listening probably don't know that most of the hormones that women take come from the urine of a variety of different cows and other things?
Horses,
I'm sorry. And as a lawyer, I complained for years, and I listened to all of my female clients tell me how these drugs turned them into Hyde immediately. And they were just horrible for women, and now they're finding all these hormones for women that were made from this horse urine are actually causing cancer and a wide variety of other problems. So, they just rush into using things. So be careful. For those women who are taking Premarin and these other hormones, look at it, and it should have a warning. Do you know you're consuming horse urine? And I really think they should.
Well,
so,
tell me about
some of its better uses.
So tell us, Simon, about the better uses of urine. Since it was brought up last week.
I mean, the chances are that if you have a leather jacket, someone's pissed on it.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't get over that. I never knew that tanning was done by soaking animal skins in urine to remove the hair fibers. I never knew that. And that they also used it during munitions. Urine has been used in manufacturing of gunpowder, nitrogen sources, using the textile industry in Scotland. The process of stretching tweed is used with soaking in urine. And the fertilizer, I guess it's also used in the fertilizer.
Well, we'll come back to fertilizer in a minute, but I can't get past the tanning. Ash and I had a friend who was from Terre Haute, Indiana. He used to tell us that he played basketball for the Terre Haute Terrible Shit Asses, which was his favorite story about Terre Haute. But his family were in the tanning business, and we're talking the 20s and 30s. And he used to tell me how horrible it was to go into the tanning sheds and how when he was young, his older brother and his friends, and of course, he told me this story, he was probably 70 and he was still mad at his older brother for it, threw him into one of the vats. Well, now I understand why he was so upset. He didn't tell me what was in the vats they used for the tanning process. Did he ever tell
No,
you
he
that?
Never told me either. So I guess that cattle urine was more useful than we knew.
So now I understand why he was mad at his brother for 50 years, for God's sake.
Hundreds of years ago, it was mainly human.
Oh, yeah.
No, was it really?
Yes. Oh, yes.
I know that we have a piece of art from my great-grandfather, and the yellow in the flowers was actually... But at least I know that under that glass is our DNA.
Well, and I laugh because, 300 years ago, how do you get a bull to pee on your leather? I mean, so it had to be humans, right?
Right. Well, there's an old saying. I don't know if you hear it much here in the U.S., but it's still fairly popular in England. And it refers to someone that doesn't have any money. He doesn't have a pot to piss in.
Or he's piss poor.
But the pot to piss in actually refers to the collection of urine for the tanning process.
Right. And that's when they decided to tax it. And that's when the British government decided to have a piss tax. There was a way to make money. Imagine that, having your urine weighed by
your
tax collector.
So your job for the day is to drink a lot of water and make sure you have a pot.
Yeah.
Right.
I imagine that would maybe that was a home job, you know, like computer home jobs. Stay at home and drink water and fill up these little vats for the tanning process.
I never thought of that.
Neither did I until now.
The enterprising tavern owner, he had no end of opportunity to make money.
Oh, I'm sure. Pour that beer.
Or pay a lot of taxes, that's right. I found the story kind of interesting, knowing that in the 1600s, that the alchemists were trying to extract yellow for gold from the urine.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, in those days, everybody had a great idea, so turning urine into gold certainly was the one that passed by a few lunkheads who didn't think about it. But let's go to the other interesting one. Urine is a major source of agriculture. By drying it out and removing the nitrogen, it becomes a fertilizer. And so much of this fertilizer you buy, pure nitrogen, comes from the use of those urine. But we think about factory farms, which we talk a lot about, how they generate the average cow generates 14 times the amount of manure and urine that the average human does. And they collect that, and a lot of that is turned into fuel. But as we also discussed, they go in these huge, you know, pools. So they're really pools of nothing but fecal waste from these animals, and they need to find some way to turn that into a more usable form of nitrogen instead of having them explode and run off in the water, because they had a problem, I believe, is outside of somewhere in the eastern side towards the Palouse country of Washington, the state of Washington, where that happened, and it washed into the rivers all the way to Seattle. So that's a big problem in some areas.
I would imagine, do you think a lot of this backup might be because they're now spraying on synthetic nitrogen than what's created in a lab rather than using this natural source? Do you think, Manny, that that's why there's so much overload of cesspools of this stuff right now?
Well, no. We're up to, 350 Americans who drink too much liquids and eat too much fast foods and generate too much waste behind them, and we don't find some way to recycle all of this. We're going to be a nation buried in whatever word you want to use for it. And that is a problem. In Los Angeles, when we have overflows with the sewer system or rain problems, it washes out through some of the drains on the beach, and they have to close beaches, particularly Santa Monica Beach, Dockweiler Beach, and down the Orange County area because of waste blowover. So Los Angeles is a typical example where we don't use the rainwater when it comes down. We should have cisterns or more reservoirs to save the rainwater when we've had rain like this in the last 2 weeks. And we don't do enough processing of the human waste, which is dangerous. It's destroyed the fishing in Southern California, and ultimately is destroying the ocean. So that's a concern.
Yeah, this one was pretty interesting, too, was the fact that during World War One, the Germans were experimenting with poisonous gases, and the first German chlorine gas attacks, the Allied troops were given masks of cotton pads soaked in urine because they believed that that would neutralize the chlorine. So the urine pads were actually held over the soldiers' faces to escape the poisonous fumes. I found that very interesting.
Well, I'll tell you an interesting sideline. For Americans in baseball, there's a Hall of Famer named Christy Mathewson, who was one of the great baseball players of the turn of the previous century. And he trained troops during World War One on using these urine-soaked gas masks, and it didn't work. And he was affected by the gas, which ruined his baseball career, and he died, I think, in 1926 because of the side effects. Never, ever resumed his career. So it was a problem even in the testing phases for American soldiers.
Was it? Did he die as a result of the gas or the urine?
You know, I didn't ask him.
Because, you know, urine has got so much ammonia that it actually can burn. It can burn the skin. So the whole thing is just sort of absurd to me, and I wonder where I guess because they just didn't know anything about it, since there were no really chemical machines decent enough to do the breakdown on the phosphorus and the ammonia and the chemicals in it.
I don't want to give McDonald's any idea, but do you think urine would be a good source of ammonia for their ground beef?
Eat their burger, collect the urine. That's a good idea.
Well, you know, that is a problem in those restaurants when you hire teenagers, is to keep them from using the pickled barrels and other things for these type of purposes. And I'm really serious. It is a problem that even with you get dishwashers and other people who are angry, and low-end people who are just angry at society, and you got to watch out that they don't urinate into barrels.
Honey, I don't think that's what he's talking about. He's talking about the ammonia in the burger, right?
I know, but I never went
to that place.
Well, that's a problem in restaurants.
Oh my gosh.
And they are very, very vigilant to make sure they don't get it. Like, if you fire an employee, you make sure he doesn't leave you something to mess up your customers with. And that's always been a revenge thing among restaurant employees. And I know, I grew up in a restaurant. I saw it all the time.
Oh, my gosh. I'm never ordering a pickle out again.
So let's change to humane food, because we've talked about that a little too long. And maybe it fits because I was still thinking back at the stories about the sheep and all the rest, because, you know, there's a growing trend where people people for ethical treatment of animals want food to be rated according to how humane the animal is treated. So next time you buy food, it's going to have a label. This animal was shot 3 times, or it's going to have a label that says, oh, we fed it nicely before he chopped its head off, you know. But to me, there's a certain amount of weirdness to having a humane standard. They're talking about, I think there was a set standard in here I'm looking for. Oh, yeah, they talk about chicken producers can earn a 3 or 4 on a scale of 5 if they provide their birds with 2 or 3 more enrichments. What's that, candy bars?
Well, you know, they try to explain this to me at Whole Foods, because they actually have picture charts up right now. And on the pictures, you can see where they – different pictures of the chickens or whatever the meat is, and then they put this chart. I can't understand it. Then they put a chart of a number on the front where they're selling the meat to let them know it's a 2 or a 3 or a 4 as to how well they were handled.
So the program requires, among other things, that the animal producers be able to trace an animal through its life from youth to slaughter, and prohibits the use of antibiotics. I happen to agree with the antibiotics. It's a very dangerous thing given to animals that you eat, because it causes humans to build up a resistance to antibiotics. But I'm not sure I want to buy a steak that has a little card attached to it with, my name's John, I was born on the cattle farm, and they really fed me nicely till they cut my head off.
That was the problem I had with the whole chart, Manny. I started looking at the chart, and I go, oh, gosh, I could see how people become vegetarians.
Yeah. Imagine going to McDonald's and having a tag on your burger going, I lived in Iowa. They fed me genetically modified corn, shot me up with antibiotics, and I stood in a deep pit of manure and urine, and guess what? You're eating me now.
Yeah,
I mean, that'd be horrible.
And it's my pleasure to serve you.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what? That probably would do it. If people can't take the time to actually read the ingredients or care about the ingredients,
you may be right.
If they start taking pictures of their life.
Oh, but when they
like put, you're adopting a pet to eat.
But what about the paw print? You know, to make sure it's really personalized. You know, we're treating this as an absurd topic because it is somewhat absurd. It's bad enough to start doing worrying about how your animal is treated that you're eating a steak or chicken or whatever. But to have to read that, I think most Americans, assuming they did do it, would rip it off and look the other way and throw it away because they just don't really want to know. What they want to know is that American food manufacturers are taking care of them by not stuffing that food with the steroids and antibiotics. And as a food consumer, I'm more concerned with someone putting a label that said, this animal is not fed with antibiotics, is not fed human growth hormones. Imagine, you know, look at someone like Arnold Schwarzenegger in his prime, who pumped a lot of steroids, even by his own admission. Can you imagine eating dinner? Oh, he admits it. Yeah. We had a governor who left office, I think, yesterday, who was a pot-smoking, steroid-munching guy who survived politics. And maybe that's a good thing because people didn't hold his past against him. But imagine when you saw how buffed up he was in those movies. So you go look at your steak and go, this comes from a steak. It was pumped up with hormones like Schwarzenegger, got as buff as he did, and now he's on your plate. I think that's a scary thought.
Yes, it is. But And I'll tell you what, in some ways, it segues really well into what I think is a delightful story. The food critic
who got outed. Irene Verbilia works for the Los Angeles Times. She had a wanted poster literally on her for years. She basically,
because nobody saw her picture, right?
Nobody saw her picture. She wrote articles for the L.A. Times. She was one of these slash and dash critics. The duck tasted horrible. I wouldn't eat here. And she was hated by a great many people in the restaurant business. So she ducked into a new restaurant in Beverly Hills called the Red Medicine. And it's a lovely new restaurant that serves modern Vietnamese food, competing with some of the other better-known ones. And she was ID'd immediately. And the manager of the restaurant made her wait about 40 minutes and walked out with a camera, took her picture, and said, "This isn't someone we want in our restaurant," and asked her to leave. And then he took her photo and he published it on the Internet. Can you imagine it? Just like a post office photo. This is this woman, Irene Verbilia, wanted dead or alive photo. Do not let her in her restaurant. So it became a huge uproar because she managed to spend 15 years without anybody getting a photo of her. So the LA Times started running articles saying that, we defend all this because we don't want special meals, and she has to, do this. She makes her reservations under phony names and uses a different credit card so nobody will know who she is. And that's probably because they're afraid she'll never get served again. So how do you feel about it, Simon, making a critic wait 40 minutes and throwing her out of a restaurant?
I think it's delightful, but I think it's also kind of pointless.
Well, life is pointless, but people do what they do. And in this case, I guess in the restaurant business, and I know a lot of people in the restaurant business who feel this way, that critics have nothing better to do than to write articles and make them funny and cute about their restaurants, but not necessarily represent the truth. And I'm sure you've seen that with people who review books, because you yourself are a reviewer, that people worry about that.
Well, yeah, but I think there's a distinct difference between the words critic and reviewer. I don't tend to go out and specifically pick something apart, whether it's music, books, food, whatever. Now, a critic is, the very definition of the word, that they're someone that is not going to play up the good side. They're going to concentrate on the downside. I mean, it's no wonder the woman was hated.
Oh, yeah.
Plus, I think it's tough because if a person goes in and criticizes a restaurant based on maybe that particular night the chef was off or had the flu or, some problem, and now this restaurant's going to be earmarked that they're a really bad restaurant. I mean, I feel the same way about theater, and theater is the same way because it could be an opening night and the lead's not there or something, and they're going to be earmarked the rest of that run, you're a bad play, So I think critics are tough.
Actually, that's true. But the difference between film and theater critics and food critics are people can see a movie on video, DVD, they can watch it on TV, they can go, I don't want to pay attention to a critic. But it's another thing when you're sticking it in your mouth. So when they blast the food in a restaurant, it's not like sitting at home and going, I'll watch it for a while. What are you going to do? Go to a restaurant, take five bites and go, I agree with the critic and get up and leave and not pay? So I think the food criticism has far more effect than the movie criticism. But, enough of the critics. Let's talk about the really fun stories. This one really got me. It's about an Iraqi girl's thinly veiled rebellion. It's about a teenage girl named Ban, the perfect name for this story, in the Shiite shrine city of Najaf, which is in Iraq. It's probably about 60 miles from Baghdad. And she became an emo. And so she dresses like an emo under her headscarf and robes. So I'm sure the younger generation know what an emo is, but for the older generation, it's a style of rock music characterized by, you know, kind of a weird melodic style, very expressive, very much, you know, confession, sort of like the Woody Guthrie folk songs of the 30s and 40s. Started in the mid-80s, became popular in the 90s, and it's sort of like a goth, the people dress in black with the weird fishnet stockings, only think of it as goth with sequins, because they're allowed to wear bright and shiny clothes when the goths aren't. But they're both into punk rock, indie rock, and it became mainstream in the last decade. So here's this girl in Iraq. Now, how she saw emo music and got involved with this in Iraq is, I guess, can only be the subject of what she saw soldiers doing or someone on local TV. But this is what Iraq's afraid of. She's 15 years old. She likes dark, ripped gloves, silver butterfly shirts, and white dice on a chain. She paints her nails black and brushes on matching eyeshadow. That could get you killed in some Muslim country.
Oh, absolutely. No matter how, because she's leaving out things that are can't cover it up with the burqa that she's got on.
Yeah, so she's Baghdad's transplant, probably calls herself the first emo. Can you imagine that? Shows up at schools wearing sneakers that peek out from under a road, a skull sketched on one foot and an angel on the other. Can you imagine that?
No, not in Iraq.
But, you know, this is what the Muslim governments are concerned about there, is that we are corrupting them. And I remember a story that I've told Ashley a number of times. In 1979, I watched a concert by Elton John that says, "To Russia with Elton." And if anyone hasn't seen it, an Elton John fan, it's worth watching. The music's okay. He traveled with Ray Cooper, the famous drummer and percussionist, alone, and they were the first rock and rollers allowed into Russia. When you see this, you see everybody wearing American jeans, speaking English, singing the songs in English. And as the concert went on, the Russian army tried to restrain them. They'd go, "Sit down, you can't stand up." And Elton John would stand up and scream, "F you, leave them alone." And he would welcome them up to the stage. And the poor Russian soldiers didn't know what to do. They were used to concerts and opera and ballet where people sit in their chairs and politely clap. They'd never seen a rave party or anybody going really nuts over this. And I turned to my son at the time and I said, "You know, 10 years of ice cream, refrigerators, and rock and roll, and Russia will fall." And it was 10 years later they fell. And that's one of the things, one of the reasons the Arab countries are so against McDonald's, rock and roll, and all this, because what it does is it corrupts their youth, and the next generation gets old enough, which is what's happening in China, where they reject what their parents and grandparents did. And they're afraid of the same movement towards democracy that's sweeping among the youth, and whether you're going to Tiananmen Square or not, that's happening across the world. So in many respects, this fight is a fight for the culture. And here's this girl in Iraq who, in many respects, is emblematic of the problem throughout the world for emerging nations trying to avoid the influence of American trash, like the same ones we're trying to get rid of.
But I found it also interesting, the fact that her father had been killed by gunmen in a car, and the consequences were they were, and then the entire family was supposed to be killed. And so when they were forced to move to another town to be with other relatives, psychologically, you could see where this would be a breaking point for her tradition, and doing this other, going into this emo. And I wonder how many other kids are affected by this, and this is going on in Iraq.
Well, I think part of the story says that she was depressed. She combined a search on the internet for songs and became a fan of a group called Evan Science, which I've never heard of. It's a moody goth band, which I've never heard of. But the fact that these teenagers can use iTunes and any one of a number of things to download American music, which is corrupting them. She says in this article, what drove her with these lyrics, "Fear is only in our minds, but it's taking over all the time. You poor sweet innocent thing, dry your eyes and testify." So she used this speech out of the little emo song to motivate her to rebel in a country where she can kill for being a rebellious. It's amazing.
Oh, so horrible. And the band that you mentioned, I'm almost certain I've interviewed them.
Well, of course you have, Simon.
So, you know, she went to visit some friends in Baghdad, and she wasn't sure it was okay until she found out that her friends were wearing jeans and black leather bracelets and canvas Converse sneakers and hiding it the fact that they were emos, too. I mean, as you go through this story, it's like there's building this subculture of people in Iraq, young girls, basically, who are in a rebellion. It's almost like Elvis is playing there in 1955. You know, this is what it reminds me of.
And you're right, man. It is kind of like the fall of Russia and even the Berlin Wall. You said once they start getting our music and our things, democracy followed because they wanted independence.
So the story goes on. She goes back to school, and she recruited 9 other girls to become emos just like her. Wow. So what happens when she converts the entire class and parents, everybody show up to find all their daughters with fishnet stockings on, black leather gloves, and this bright red lipstick?
Under the black.
And when I find the girls are harmonizing on songs, Eminem's songs and 50 Cent, I really worry. Because I think if they ever did that in public, they'd get stoned. So let's move on to a companion story, because I want to compare her to other things that are going on in the Muslim world. Here's a story about a guy who killed his daughter in Iraq because she was linked to Al-Qaeda. So the police were hunting for a 19-year-old woman when they believed she'd been recruited by Al-Qaeda to become a suicide bomber. They found she was already dead.
3 months.
3 months earlier, slain by her father, who told police he strangled his daughter out of shame and then cut her throat. The father just described her as a grave in the backyard. And then they found out, I think it was 1984, that he'd killed his sister, basically because it was a so-called honor killing. So here's a guy who was willing to kill his sister and to kill his daughter for honor. And yet we have another young girl, Ban, who is basically rebelling in a way that's just as bad as the Al-Qaeda rebellion. So where do you draw the line between what children and teenagers in these countries can do and can't do? They're just trying to control them the way our parents did in the 1950s.
And
so you have any thoughts about that, Simon?
I see change coming in Iraq, Iran, all of the Middle East, but I don't see it as quite the peaceful, love summer of 67.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you, Simon.
Yeah. So you must be leaning towards that story about the student who was stoned to death, and I believe that was in Pakistan, because that's now popular. He refused, I believe it was.
No, it was actually in Baghdad, in Iraq.
Oh, you're right.
Najaf, Iraq and Baghdad.
Yeah, which is the same city
right.
She lives in. So in the same city she lives in, a 14-year-old boy refused to give up his stationery to teenage bullies, so the students waited for him to get after school, and they gripped pencils, rocks, and they just kept beating him up and throwing things at him until he died.
On a 14-year-old.
So here, her rebellion, when contrasted with that, is even more remarkable. So I think right now that's where the struggle is controlling the youth of America.
I think that the youth in the Middle East are the future. But it's going to be a long and bloody struggle.
And not in my lifetime, for sure. We're getting to the end of the show. Would you believe that? And there's something I really wanted to do last week that really needs a little scream out. A gentleman by the name of Fred Foy died. He was the announcer of The Lone Ranger, which won't mean very much to young audiences, but except for the fact that he was also the announcer for Dick Cavett on television. And he was also the backup, and one time did The Lone Ranger on the radio, and he was famous for those famous words, a fiery horse and a speed of light, a cloud of dust and a hearty hi-yo silver. You remember those when you were young, Simon?
Oh, absolutely, and that was a very good impression.
Well, I usually do it better. I didn't want to do it now. And he would say, return to us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past came the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again. I can remember it like I was 8 years old. I mean, they never shot it off this set. It was one of the cheapest TV shows around, but the kids loved him. So to Fred Foy, a brilliant announcer, lived to 89 years old, who at one time was the best there was at his business, God bless him.
And I do remember the Lone Ranger. Lord, I'm old.
Now, did you enjoy him?
Oh, absolutely.
I'll tell you a story. Later in life, Clayton Moore played the role, started doing PR work because he was tight on money. He was now 65, 70 and started doing public appearances. And would you believe the owner of the rights sued him and stopped him from being the Lone Ranger later in his life because they owned the patent rights and it disturbed everybody in Los Angeles. It was a terrible thing for all of us, and we just thought it was cowardly. So wherever he is, Clayton Moore, God rest his soul, was another person who was never truly recognized for his gift.
Isn't there a museum somewhere in California?
Yes, the Gene Autry Western Museum. It's right next to the L.A. Zoo where the 134 freeway and the 5 join, about 2 miles from Dodger Stadium, 5 miles from downtown L.A. And it's a wonderful, wonderful place to visit. Gene Autry, Monty Montana. In fact, some of Roy Rogers' stuff is there. And anyone visiting Los Angeles would really, really enjoy that.
I loved it. We had fun that day. Manny's friends, of course, I'm the only one who did it. I was the fool. Manny's friends all said, we're going to go to Gene Autry's museum, but we're going to dress. So I threw on my cowgirl hat. I had a whole girl, cowgirl costume. And I show up, and everybody's in Hawaiian shirts.
You're also 2 hours late from rehearsal. But
well, that's okay.
We won't
story.
Even get into that. So, Simon, it's all yours. Sign us out.
Okay. It has been a wonderful show, as always. And I do want to thank my guests, Manny Barling and Ashley Brooks, for taking time out to talk with us all today. Have a great week, folks.
And I hope everybody enjoyed this show more than our one listener who was unhappy.
And to all the soldiers out there, we are sending you our hearts and our love.
And I will also put in a quick advert. Manny and Ashley will be back on the air on Saturday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. And we have a very, very special guest. Do you want to give us the quick thumbnail sketch?
It's Patrick Kilpatrick, who has done over 100 movies and 100 films. He is with Greenpeace. He's a member of Greenpeace. He has done countless vet charities and charities raise fundraising throughout the world. And he's just an absolutely brilliant writer, and he's a University of New York grad.
And among other things, NYU grad, among other things, he has been into health for 45 years. I'm going to talk about why at his age he looks young enough to play early age roles by eating organic food. He grew up on a farm in Virginia, and he's going to talk about growing up on a farm and food, which is something we do on Saturday morning. So learn how one man's done it for 45 years and why he's alive in great health and looking 20 years younger than he really is.
Brilliant man with a great heart.
Oh, I am very much looking forward to the program. Okay, I have to wrap this up. It's been delightful. Till Saturday, I'll bid you adieu.
Adieu.
Adieu.